Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And just as a quick reminder for those that are joining us live, make sure and join in the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. If you come up with a question you think would be really good for Eagle One or myself to ask our guests, or you just have a generalized observation you'd like to share with us, that's the way to do it. I'll be monitoring that throughout the show. And if you're new to Midrats or you want to catch up on the shows you missed, you can always get the archive over at Blog Talk Radio or listen at your own leisure by subscribing to the podcast over on iTunes, free of charge as always. Just another side note, occasionally on a show, we will go over. The live audio goes dead the 60-minute mark, but we keep chatting away because we want to finish up a point. The show does keep going, and you can catch those last few minutes over in the archive, so don't feel like you missed something or that we don't watch the clock, though guilty on that charge half of the time. Now let's get on with the show. In the 14 months since our guest today's last visit to Midrats, there's been quite a few developments in the Afghan-Pakistan theater and, in a larger sense, the long war that we're in. Some have been for the good and some for the bad, depending upon your goals and outlook. You know, recently, there's been a renewed emphasis on the Haqqani network, the drone wars, and, of course, since his last visit, Osama bin Laden was found and measured and taken care of. We also have the inevitable withdrawal that's going to take place in the summer of 2014, barring something unusual. And what we want to do is we want to take a moment to see where we stand here in the gathering fall of 2011 in the Afghan-Pakistan theater and where we're trending to. And our guest for the full hour will be the managing editor for the Long Wars Journal, Bill Rocio. Bill, welcome to Midrats.
Oh, thanks, gentlemen. It's always a pleasure. Good to talk with you again.
And thanks again for coming on this Sunday. It's a fertile ground. Right before we gave you a call in the pre-show, Eagle One and I were talking about, well, I think we might just wander off the AFPAC theater because there's a lot of news going on. And being that you are the managing editor of the Long War, we have a little broader sense of what's going on. But I wanted to take a moment, if you could, explain to the listeners what is the background and the goals of the Long War Journal and also the Foundation for Defensive Democracies.
Yeah, sure. I established the Long War Journal back in 2007. That really started up from my personal blog, which from several years prior. But our goal is to provide coverage of that global war on terror, which we call the Long War. We're looking not just at the counterinsurgency / counterterrorism fights in Iraq and Afghanistan where U.S. troops are, but we're looking at the other theaters, the dirty wars in Pakistan, Somalia, in Yemen. We're looking at al-Qaeda's operations and tactics, allied terrorist groups, the Taliban, you know, obscure groups like Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan or Shabab in Somalia. And, you know, we're trying to fill in those gaps where, you know, provide that expertise where we think the established media, which I think, you know, there's good reports out there, but we try and take those reports to the next level and provide that extra layer of detail. Another big topic of coverage of ours from Tom Jocelyn does, I think he's the foremost expert on Guantanamo and the prisoners down there. We track the recidivists. We're you know, looking at the legal cases, it's very, very interesting stuff. High recidivism rate from Guantanamo. So, yeah, we're taking a look at all of those things as well as keeping an eye on North Africa and in Southeast Asia. There's Al-Qaeda-allied terrorist groups in Indonesia and in the Philippines, and there's an insurgency, Islamist insurgency in Thailand. So we're trying to keep an eye on all of those things, and we're tracking it daily. Let me one more thing. Foundation of Defense of Democracies, that is my sponsor. I'm a senior fellow there. And, they have a more broader goal, which is the promotion and establishment of democracies across the world. I mean, they believe that, one of the problems in particularly in the Middle East and in North Africa and places where terrorism threatens the United States, that a solution is to have democratic governments that are responsible to the people. I'm a believer that, we're going to work out, we're going to have a lot better results. We're going to have a lot, when people are responsible and their governments are responsible to the people, then, they're not going to be so apt to, fund and arm terrorists and send them against other democratic nations.
Wow. Of all the things, I'm going to put you on the spot with a prognostication request. Of all the things we're looking at in the Long War Journal and in the Long War generally, what do you see as the most immediate thing we should be keeping our eye on?
Yeah, I think that, and this is the most of our problems, if not all of them, stem from the fact that we fail to recognize the state aspect in all this. Pakistan and Iran are the two biggest state sponsors of terror. It's undeniable at this point. You have Iran sponsoring, openly sponsors Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, terror groups operating in Iraq, and even a plot that was foiled by the U.S. government that was supposed to kill the Saudi ambassador in the United States. You have in Pakistan, it's just sponsors the plethora of terror groups that attack India, that conduct attacks in the disputed territory of Kashmir and Jammu. You have, they're sponsoring groups like the Haqqani Network, the Afghan Taliban, to kill our troops inside Afghanistan and NATO troops as well. All of these plots that are being launched against the United States are ultimately tracked back to Pakistan's tribal areas. And then the other aspect of this is sort of ungoverned spaces or failed states. You have that in Yemen and Somalia, although even the Yemeni government at times has sponsored terror groups. They look the other way or provided training to Al-Qaeda and other insurgents that went to fight U.S. forces in Iraq. Now the state is collapsing, and you have an ungoverned space there. Same thing with Somalia. Shabab controls much of that country, even with offensives from neighboring. African countries, all involved in Somalia. It's an absolute mess. So that's the another aspect there, and that's one that we seem to understand. When I say we, I'm talking about the policymakers in D.C., but it's very difficult to deal with. The first problem, the state sponsorship, we just refuse to recognize this. We're trying to deal with the symptom, which is groups like Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and Lashkar-e-Taiba, when not dealing with the disease, which is those states that really sponsor them.
Let's pull this thread on dealing with the symptoms here, because back when I was in the operational planning game in Afghanistan a few years ago when I was still in uniform, the Haqqani network was always three or four slides back in the morning brief, so to speak, when we were talking about what we were trying to do, what the threats were. We knew what Haqqani was. It was generally looked at more of a extended organized crime family than the threats we were looking at from some of the more traditional Taliban groups. But we saw in the last few months a pretty concerted push, at least from what you read about in the open press, against the Haqqani network. And a lot of people were talking about Haqqani, Haqqani, Haqqani. Like all of a sudden he became the primary and really took a lot of the oxygen out of the room for the discussions, and I assume the operations as well. Why do you think recently Haqqani became such a a higher profile than that network had been in the last few years. Was there an opportunity that we saw there, or something else going on that just isn't being reported well enough in open press?
Well, yeah, you know, I got to admit, this is one of the real frustrating parts of my job, is seeing these things years in advance and just shaking my head. I remember back in, I think it was somewhere around early 2009, you had General Flynn and several other, then the ISAF chief and several other senior military leaders saying, oh, yeah, with the Haqqani network and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar from the Hizbi Islami Gulbuddin, they're just opportunists and, you know, pretty much promoting the line that you put out there. And they could be dealt with. We could cut a deal with them. They're pragmatists and whatnot. To me, it's just a real failure to understand the nature of the enemy that we're fighting. When you look at the – here's one, you know, I mean, there's multiple ways to look at how they're – look. I always say look at what they're doing. Look at their operations. They're sponsoring suicide bombers. That's a big, big, you know, indicator that they're involved in radical jihadist ideology. When we're conducting predator strikes inside of Pakistan and in North Waziristan, where the Haqqani network is based, many, many senior al-Qaeda leaders and other terrorist group leaders are being killed in these areas. And, you know, you could see this back in 2007, 2008, 2009. And yet, see, I think that part of this was that a lot of people, policymakers, senior military leaders are so eager to look for to cut a deal with someone that they're just ignoring what is right in front of their face. You know, it truly is maddening when you look, and I'm looking at this from the outside. I'm not looking at this on a daily basis with classified information. So then all of a sudden, you know, you have U.S. officials turning on a dime and you have senior Haqqani network leaders putting on the specially designated terrorist list from the U.S. government, from State and Treasury. The Haqqani network didn't just all of a sudden become a radical Islamist group. It's been like this since the 1990s. When you go back and look at their propaganda, look at who they were, how they operated, look at who they were working with. You know, it's all very clear. It's just a matter of people either not wanting to see what's in front of them or unable to see what's in front of them. So I hope that answers the question. But it truly is maddening to me.
Well, one of the questions that raises is there more of a global terrorist network than we generally have been led to believe? These aren't separate, completely separate, and it seems to me these are all not completely separate entities when you talk about the force in Somalia and the forces in the South Russia and all that. I mean, are they all tied together in some way that we should be more aware of?
Yeah, I mean, look, when you look at, you know, where did radical Islamists move after they defeated the Soviets in Afghanistan? They went to Bosnia, they went to Sudan, they went to Russia, and they fought, you know, and they fought, and those were theaters to them. And they remain that way. Now, it's not like we're dealing with Spectre or something like that from a James Bond movie, but these groups are linked. Their leaders move in and out of each other, out of theaters. For instance, here's a good example. A guy named Osama al-Kini, who we killed in a predator strike in Pakistan, he was one of the several al-Qaeda leaders who was involved in Kenya and Tanzania back in 2008, operating in the Horn of Africa, in 1998, involved in, you know, those massive suicide attacks against the embassies. And, you know, 12 years later, he's dead in Pakistan. He was al-Qaeda's operations chief for Pakistan when we killed him. His aide also was indicted with bin Laden, Zawahiri, in the Kenyan-Tanzania bombings. He also was killed in Pakistan. We see this time and time again. Al-Qaeda sort of, you know, it brings leaders in, it puts them back in the theater. The head of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen and Somalia, or I'm sorry, Yemen and Saudi Arabia, Nasser al-Wahashi, he was Osama bin Laden's, basically his aide-de-camp for years. And then he was sent back to Yemen to form Al-Qaeda, you know, to reform Al-Qaeda there. And this is kind of what we're dealing with. Al-Qaeda Central provides support. It provides leaders back, you know, in and out from moving to and from Al-Qaeda Central to the theaters. It provides money. It provides resources. It provides propaganda support, and you know, other and other. You know, this is how the network works, and we want to keep saying, oh, well, you know, I mean, I saw this for sure. You know, Shabab is another case. Shabab in Somalia. I reported back in 2008 it was an al-Qaeda affiliate. It, when you looked at how their propaganda, Saleh Ali Navhan, who we killed in a special operations raid, I believe in 2009 or 2010, I think it was late 2009, he reached out to al-Qaeda Central, and Saleh Ali Navhan was one of the ones indicted with bin Laden. He reached out on behalf of Shabab to say, hey, we want to join al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda basically responded, Zawahiri, Abu Yahya al-Libi, and Osama bin Laden were like, you know, hey, that's great. And, you know, look, what more do we need to know that it's an al-Qaeda affiliate at that point? You had several al-Qaeda, top al-Qaeda leaders that were senior leaders in Shabab. They reached out. They got approval. They received resources. They're mentioned very often in al-Qaeda's central's propaganda. So, you know, it only took till this year until people actually started to recognize that al-Qaeda, Shabab, was an al-Qaeda affiliate. You know, we look, you know, even after 9/11, what did everyone say after 9/11? We need to figure out how to connect the dots. Yet analysts, policymakers do everything in their power to disconnect the dots until they're unable to deny what's in front of their face.
Amen. I mean, that's... Yeah, every time you start to talk about this, just a little sidebar issue, I have always liked the term long war. And I know a few years ago it fell out of favor. People didn't like using it. And recently it's come back into use again because it really is the only accurate phrase out there to describe what we're in if you're looking for a macro term. Because every time you go through an exercise and you just did it perfectly, you really feel like you need to have a 4-foot by 8-foot whiteboard with 5 different color pens to go up there and start diagramming the network, because this is really something that there is no one center of gravity. There are multiple centers of gravity, and they're amorphous, and it is. This is not going to be a quickie. This isn't going to be a fast way to get out of it. And the part of the reason that it's such a long war and it's so diffuse is it really relies on a large body of water to swim in, which is the, you know, billion-plus Muslim population, and specifically those areas that are fairly ungoverned that they can swim in. And when we talk about the AFPAC theater, which I first started hearing about that context when it started being pushed that way back in 07 at CENTCOM, as opposed to looking at Pakistan and Afghanistan, let's put them together and let's talk about AFPAC. But that key characteristic of the Pashtun Belt, the lack of governability, the access to money through drugs, and the perverse, two-faced actions of Pakistan with their obsession with India. What are the easy to fix problems in AFPAC, if there are any? But what are those that you see that we have just got to learn how to mitigate the impact, because there really is no reasonable way that we're going to be able to get the effects that we want?
Well, I'm not certain that there is an easy fix solution. And given our inability to call Pakistan what it is, an actual state sponsor of terror, you know, I see that everything and anything that we're doing is merely chipping away at the edges. We can conduct predator strikes and, you know, everyone thinks, oh, this is great. You know, we've got unmanned aircraft and we could just attack in Pakistan's ungoverned spaces until the cows come home. Well, guess what? There's real repercussions for that. That looks easy. When you look at it that way, when you're not looking at how the Pakistani government, how the Pakistani people are reacting to it, how it's being touted in the Arab world. You know, I hate to be such a pessimist when it comes, and I tend to be optimistic by nature, but when I look at what's happening in Afghanistan, I can't see, I see no daylight there until we actually change our approach and the way we recognize the issues there. You know, we could stay in Afghanistan for another 10 or 20 years, but we can't. I mean, we're unable to do so at a manned at the way we need to, which is a large force just to basically hold it. I mean, we've had 130,000 collectively with U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, and yet there's vast areas of Afghanistan that are still under enemy control, even in Helmand and Kandahar provinces where we've had the most success. And, you know, we can't, you know, the Afghan security forces are I don't believe they're going to be up to the task in 2014, let alone, I don't think they'll be up to the task in 2020. We have a better chance in 2020 than we would in 2014. Pakistan is still going to continue to meddle in Afghanistan. It's still going to support groups like the Taliban. It's still going to support groups like the Haqqani Network. You know, when you had mentioned, you know, the term with the long war, one of the reasons I liked that when I first started hearing it, when I named the website, it wasn't just because this is what U.S. policymakers were calling the war back in 2000, you know, in 2004, 2005, 2006, but it's also what the Taliban has said, the way they view the conflict, and it's that famous saying, and which I'll probably butcher here, but the Taliban's, what they say about us or the West is, we the West have all the clocks, but they have all the time. That's how they view it. Look at Afghanistan. We beat the snot out of the Taliban and routed Al-Qaeda and their Brigade 055, that was their military force, back in 2001 and 2002. They were a spent force, retreated into Iran and retreated into Pakistan. But it took them years to regroup with the help of the Pakistani state and others. And they did, and they came back into 2007, 2008, 2009, and really had us back on our heels. And that's the way they view these conflicts. They're not looking at it, you know, they don't have a timeline. They don't say, well, by 2014, we need to do X, Y, and Z. They'll come back, and they'll try another iteration at this until they get it right. Look at here's another good example of this is how they view the long war. They wanted to take down the World Trade Center. And the first attempt to do so failed in 1993. And when Ramzi Youssef was captured by the FBI, and they were questioning him, and they flew by the airplanes, the story is that he said to one of the FBI agents, he said, those towers will come down. And they did. They came down years later because Al-Qaeda is patient. I'm not trying to overhype this group. I'm not a booster. We are able to defeat them if we approach this right. But I think the real problems are that we don't have the right approach to this. We don't view the issue of state sponsorship of terrorism seriously. And until we do, we're going to continue to just chip away at the edges and claim that if we just kill X amount of leaders of Al-Qaeda, the group will collapse.
Yeah, after the president's West Point speech, where he originally announced the summer of 2011, that I think it was Gates and Petraeus that talked him into shifting that to the right to the summer of 2014. You know, one of the things that hit me is like we've just lost our strategic patience, and I think that's obvious. You know, we can say what we want to the American public, but the rest of the world sees exactly what's going on, and it played right into, you know, one of Bin Laden's favorite phrases. In addition to the clocks and the time, was the strong horse, weak horse. And when you combine that to what you had mentioned before, the increase in drone strikes and the increasing pressure that people are, in some segments, trying to put towards Pakistan, you know, Karzai's statement in the last, I think, 24 to 36 hours, where he stated that, you know, in the event of an American attack on Pakistan, Afghanistan will stand with Pakistan against the Americans. A lot of that, perhaps, you can excuse as the rhetorical flourish that's common in that part of the world. But doesn't that really kind of emphasize the fact that we are looking at this problem very different from those who actually have to live, breathe, and have their families there? And that perhaps is part of our disconnect that we're trying to get to where we want to be.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, in part, look, I can't pretend to know what Karzai's motivation for saying that is. I can only guess. But I think here's a reasonable guess. Karzai has been, you know, he's schizophrenic when it comes to statements like this. But he'll often make statements like this to try and attempt to appease Pakistan because you've had a lot of senior officials inside of Afghanistan assassinated that the Afghan security officials have directly pointed to the Pakistani government. So who knows? Maybe Karzai's trying to ingratiate himself with the Pakistanis or get himself off that target list or let the Pakistanis know, hey, I can be your guy too, given that the Americans are going. But I don't think we'd see statements like this or statements like he's made recently where he said that, you know, the Taliban are just his wayward brothers and things of that nature. If the U.S. was taking and NATO itself were taking a tough stand and were saying they were committed to the fight, the more we tell, you know, people that we don't have the stomach for this, the more they're going to look for alternate solutions. And it is absolutely viewed as weakness. And you know, you have to look at this. This isn't just something where, well, the Afghans and the Pakistanis see us weak. How does China view this? How does South Korea view this? How do other countries who are U.S. allies that are dependent on the U.S. for their security, you know, are we to be considered that strong, you know, that strong horse, as you said, or are they going to have to start looking for other options? And you know, unfortunately, there are real national security and foreign policy implications when you act this way, when you tell the world we are no longer willing to stand by our allies, or in the case of Iraq, we're no longer willing to attempt to uphold and defend those 9 years of sacrifice that we made in a country. And I think this is a really dangerous time, and it's a really dangerous message that's being put out by this administration.
Well, I would gather from that, then, Bill, that you're not in favor of time-based withdrawal plans, and I mean, it doesn't that just play into this America's lacks the attention span to fight a long war, and that's how we're going to beat them? We can just outlast them.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, and you're correct. I am not a fan of time-based plans. I didn't like it when President Bush did it back in 2007, 2008 with the surge in Iraq. I do think that given the way the Iraqi security forces were developing, that it was, and I think that it was much more possible to get away with it in that case. But even then, the message sent wasn't good. And, you know, and it's also what's gotten us into this bind in Iraq right now, where we can't keep forces in country because we can't come to agreement on a status of forces agreement after the December withdrawal date. So, yeah, I think that it sends a lot of bad messages. I don't think it provides an incentive for countries to improve the way they're doing things. I think if countries wanted, you know, if the people in these countries want things to be better, then they'll work to make them better, whether there's a timeline on them or not. And I think Iraq is a good case of this. I don't think that the withdrawal timeline, you know, force the Iraqis to step up and handle their security. Having spent 5 straight years embedding with Iraqi security forces in Iraq, 4 years, I apologize, you know, I saw that they were working hard to do this, that they wanted to provide for their own security. In Afghanistan, we don't see that so much. But on a much broader level, when we're telling the rest of the world that, hey, it's going to be, we're going to go this far and no further, it really just does not encourage other countries to want to work with us.
Eagle One?
Hello?
Yeah, let me follow up on that with,
sure,
with somebody. One of the questions that came up in the chat room had to do with is Pakistan a failed state with a nuke? And I guess the question is there any thought that if we wait long enough, somehow Pakistan will miraculously become a real country, a really organized country, or is this kind of we're looking at a basket case with a lot of power?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't believe that Pakistan is actually a failed state at the moment. I think Pakistan is operating just the way the Pakistani military wants it to operate. Its government is a government name only, and the Pakistani military really wields the levers of power there. I think everything's working just the way that they want it. So what you have is you have a terror sponsoring state that is in possession of nuclear weapons. That government in Pakistan is really that's just a front that makes people in the West feel good. Well, we could talk to Prime Minister Gilani, we could talk to Foreign Minister Carr, we could talk to President Zardari, but they don't if they don't toe the line of the Pakistani military, their heads are on a chopping block, and that's just the reality of the situation. The question of whether we can wait out Pakistan, I don't think this is possible, and I think that the potentials, the risks of doing so are great, because what is going to happen? What would happen? And we came real close in May 2010 when Faisal Shahzad, who trained inside of Pakistan, almost set a car bomb off in Times Square. Those type of plots are being hatched against the U.S. all the time. We didn't detect that one. The only reason that one failed was because he just didn't build his detonator well enough, or there probably would have been 30, 40, 50 dead Americans in Times Square, and all of the repercussions of having a car bomb go off, a major car bomb go off in the heart of America, arguably. I don't believe that we have the luxury of waiting out Pakistan on this. I think it's dangerous to do. I don't think we have the patience to wait out Pakistan on this one either. And I don't think we would even understand how to wait them out. And then this idea of, well, we can, let's not fund the Pakistani military, we'll just fund government institutions and government projects. I just don't think people understand that money is fungible, and the more money that goes into Pakistani government projects, assuming it's not being filtered away by Pakistani elites and being put in their pocket anyway, so it's just an elaborate bribe, which is pretty much what happens in Pakistan. Their president, Zardari, his nickname is Mr. 10%, so I think that tells you all you need to know about how things work there. Money is fungible, and that's less money that the Pakistanis have to put to those other institutions, and more they could put into their government. Look, that Pakistan had major flooding and mass displacement last year, and yet the Pakistani defense budget rose, I believe, somewhere between 15% to 20%, and I could be wrong on that number, but it's in the double digits.
Funny, there was a phrase back in the 19th century that Prussia was an army that had a nation, as opposed to the usual way where nations have armies.
It's the perfect analogy is Prussia, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think we should all be lucky that at least the Pakistani army isn't as efficient as the Prussians, and we might have other issues.
Yeah, but the Prussians didn't have nukes either.
That's a fact.
Or a global, global modes of transportation and communication that allowed Prussian agents to sabotage throughout the world.
When heading across the army a bit, heading across the border a little bit, putting my little Afghan hat, I remember sitting at a table with some Afghan colonels, and you had a Pashtun who had a family in Germany. There was a Tajik who had family in Canada, and the Hazara colonel that they always talk bad about behind his back, he had relatives in Belgium. But looking at the announcement that we've made about our calendar-based withdrawal, and they remember very well the Soviets with the Friendship Bridge. Everything didn't collapse right away. It took a few years after the Friendship Bridge before everything went to crap. But if I was an Uzbek, a Tajik, or a Hazar, one of the things I would be doing would be making sure that my ethnic and tribal infrastructure were rearming. Are we seeing that at this point where they are starting to think that way and act that way?
Absolutely, yeah. And this started coming out last year when, talks with the Taliban really heated up, because they believe that if the Taliban is allowed to take control of levers of power in Pakistan, that it will result in civil war. So there's been a lot of talk of it. Whether they've actually, physically have begun to arm, I don't think they've ever really all turned in their weapons, despite the reports to the contrary. I don't believe they all turned in their arms. And even if they had, they'll be able to easily acquire those from neighboring countries, from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. The Russians will arm them. The Indians will arm them. The Iranians will arm them. We'll just be back to that. Whether they can hold out against the Taliban, that's a good question. I don't think all the U.S. forces are going to leave. So, what I think we'll have sometime after 2014, with my guess is 20,000-30,000 U.S. troops that are in a counterterrorism role with air support, logistical support, et cetera. And I think that, they'll be enablers for the, if the Afghan military holds together. But, if there's a negotiation, this is why I don't see a negotiated settlement coming, because I don't see the former Northern Alliance groups signing off on this. And, yeah, there has been talk of this. There's been a lot of reports on it. They've been very verbal in their opposition to any type of reconciliation. And they do believe that given that the U.S. is preparing to leave before the Afghans are ready to take control, that they do believe ultimately it will result in civil war.
Well, there's a cheery prospect.
Yeah, it's hard to find a bright spot in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I really hate to say, other than killing senior terrorist leaders, in drips and drabs, it's really difficult to find something to be positive about.
Well, that does kind of raise the question of, did we do the right thing by going in the way we did in Afghanistan? I mean, initially we were fairly low, a level low force, took out the Taliban, took out the Al-Qaeda that was there. Should we have just left then and left them to their own devices, and then if it stirred back up, come in and whack them again? Or did it make sense then and now for us to have gone and try and build something out of Afghanistan, knowing, I guess we should have known if we didn't know, that Pakistan was going to be opposed to a strong Afghanistan?
Yeah, and it's hard to argue that we shouldn't have tried, right? I mean, how do we really, should we have known that Pakistan was going to stab us in the back on this one? How do we know until we had tried it, right? The alternate, if we had just, did what we did 2001, 2002, we routed them, pulled up and said, hey, have a great time, guys. It just would have been sooner. Right? I mean, much of Afghanistan would have reverted back to Taliban control in mid-2005, 2006, somewhere in that time frame. So it's possible that what we've done is delayed the inevitable. And that could be part of the, hey, well, maybe we can convince the Pakistanis to change their ways. I don't think that's possible. I think that this is just too far ingrained into what they're doing. Again, no easy solutions. I don't have the answer to what we should have done. Yeah, we could have just cleared it out, left it, handed it over to them, given them, perhaps base some counterterrorism forces there to help out. But I still think we'd ultimately be at this point where we are, whether it had been, 2004 or 2008 or 2012, whatever it would be. It's difficult to keep launching expeditionary or punitive raids against the country time and time again. I mean, that has a cost as well, not just monetarily, but, then we start looking like the big bully on the street and launching attacks on the same country, the poor Muslims. But then again, occupation has that effect as well. There's just no easy solutions to that problem. Al-Qaeda, real, and I don't know whether this was conscious or not, but them drawing us into Afghanistan, and they'll claim it is, and it makes me wonder if they actually knew, but them drawing us into Afghanistan really was a masterful stroke, because, we were damned if we do and damned if we don't. We had to remove the Taliban from power after 9/11. They provided the safe haven for Al-Qaeda to operate. They would not turn over the Taliban. We had no other choice. The American people, I don't believe, would have stood for us doing nothing. And yet, the real question was, what do we do with it after? And there's just no good answers.
This is all interconnected. And I think one of the undertold stories the last few days, because there's a lot going on. I know everybody wants to see what's going on and occupy, enter your village here. on the news, but there is the Kenyan military and other members of the African Union are conducting not insignificant or in the process of beginning not insignificant operations in Somalia. Now, the explanation for the Ugandan, Kenyan involvement, I thought was rather interesting in one of the articles I read this morning talking about that some of the kidnappings they've done recently has really impacted what is one of their big money makers, and that is tourism. Is the Kenyans and the other African Union forces, do they really have the logistics, leadership, and will to be able to significantly do something in Somalia?
What they have the capability of beating Shabaab on the battlefield. We know this from Ethiopia's invasion in late 2006, early 2007. They did. They drove Shabaab out of all their strongholds in the south and in central Somalia and Mogadishu. But what they didn't have the ability to do was hold those gains. They didn't commit enough forces. They didn't have the logistics. And they don't know how to fight counterinsurgency. And they were, you know, are seen as an occupation force. All of the major problems. So the Ethiopians left. And so Shabaab and the Islamic courts, it was the Islamic courts union at that time, you know, they just went into insurgency mode. They regrouped, licked their wounds, and launched an insurgency, and it was able to drive the Ethiopians from the country. Then the African Union came in, and Mogadishu was contested like 95% of Mogadishu was under Shabaab control until just last summer when African Union operations drove Shabaab out, as well as Shabaab decided it's going to, you know, not fight this battle in the city. You know, then now you have the operation being launched by Kenya, but, you know, the question becomes, do they have the sticking power? Again, this is Shabaab's looking at this like, hey, yeah, we lost in 2006, 2007, the Ethiopians, but we came back. And, you know, we came back and we pretty much ruled the southern and central Somalia for 4 years until we suffered our defeat here. They're going to be back. They take that same view as the Taliban. And unfortunately, the problem with Somalia is what really needs to stand up, which is the Somali government and the Somali security forces. They are not going to be able to hold these gains. Why are the Kenyans having to launch an operation in southern Somalia? Because the Somali military, Somali police can't do it. Why is 9,000 African Union troops needed in Mogadishu to throw Shabaab out of the city? Because Somali police and Somali military forces can't do it. Those African Union countries can only stay inside Somalia for so long. And I think a lot of this is the reason Burundi and Uganda are able to do this, because the U.S. is providing a lot of money for them to do it. We're basically funding those deployments, and people in those governments are making a lot of money, kickbacks, in order to have those deployments. But there's only so long that the people of those countries are going to tolerate that.
Just a quick follow-on, just to add more darkness to the cloud in the discussion. When you look at this, the medievalist in my mind creeps to the front. And when you look at the fact that predominantly, this isn't, it's not 100% of course, Ethiopia, Uganda, Burundi, Kenya, these are predominantly Christian and animist peoples going into a, let's go ahead and call it exclusively Muslim country. When you look at the demographics there, it's very much mowing the grass. You can kill 10,000 today because in the next 2 weeks they're going to give birth to 10,000 more and then 10,000 more. And there's also a will. There's no desire to take, keep, and convert any part of Somalia into greater Kenya, greater Ethiopia, et cetera, and so forth. So when you talk at the long war and you talk about something that you mentioned early on, there's some very unpleasant aspects to the long war that people simply do not like to talk about. A lot of it has to do with demographics and the fact that we're mowing the grass. Is the new normal going to be, being that there is no indigenous Somali force in that part of Somalia, you know, Puntland and Somaliland are a different factor altogether, that this is just going to be an ongoing page A8 operation for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, in Payday 8 operation for the foreseeable future. And, you know, while we're sort of, we, you know, the forces that are against this Islamist threat are sort of trying to hold the line in places like Somalia and whatnot, you have in countries that really didn't have this problem 15 years ago, are like Nigeria, you know, with the rise of Boko Haram. They're pretty much launching a full-scale insurgency in northern Nigeria. You have Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb gaining power, and, you know, and then dealing with that with the Arab Spring. And, you know, you look at all this, it's really hard to be optimistic about this, given how, you know, it's hard for us. The only place I could see that we've made gains is places like the Philippines and Indonesia, and that's because those governments refuse to knuckle under these groups. I mean, we could say what we want about Indonesians and Indonesian culture, but, you know, they have no tolerance for Jemaah Islamiyah, Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Southeast Asia, and they've gone after them hard and are putting these guys in jails. But other than those areas, or, you know, maybe Iraq, where you have an Iraqi government, I believe, that really, you know, has suffered the worst of the Islamist threat, most other places were really just, you know, at best holding the line. And Afghanistan, Pakistan were losing, and Yemen were losing ground.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Somalia, and I have a question, because we got into Somalia originally back in Black Hawk Down days as part of a humanitarian intervention. And we've been kind of stuck around ever since. But in the perfect world, the fact that Shabab is, or the Kenya gets involved because some people from Somalia are going down and kidnapping tourists, we wouldn't really care. I mean, what do we care what happens in Somalia, except, I guess, to the extent that we're worried that it will become another Afghanistan for Al-Qaeda to launch attacks on the U.S. Is there any other reason, you know, of course it's the piracy issue, but is there any other reason we should even care what happens in Somalia?
Well, yeah, I mean, if Shabab wasn't part of Al-Qaeda's network, then, you know, you say, hey, it's a local problem and one they're going to have to sort out on their own. But here's a problem when you look at Shabab. You have scores of American recruits going to Somalia. Several of them have carried out suicide bombings inside Mogadishu. You know, when does that network of recruiting get turned around and be used to conduct attacks inside the United States? Is that just a matter of time? So those are the concerns that we have. Again, if Shabab was just a local group, let's put it this way, if Shabab was just the Lord's Resistance Army and was you know, dedicated to local mayhem, then, yeah, you know, I mean, I hate to be callous, but that's their problem. But once it becomes part of Al-Qaeda's network, which is, and they're committed to conducting attacks against us, then it becomes our problem. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, no, there was never a threat to the United States. Why should we care? Then you have Abu Abdul Muttalib try to detonate a bomb over Detroit on Christmas Day. It's our problem then at that point in time. They try to put, you know, parcel bombs in UPS or FedEx airplanes and blow them up over Western countries. Yeah, that becomes our problem. That's the real crux of the problem. This is all part of Al-Qaeda's network. Sometimes it's not as tight, you know, again, as a specter, but it is part of Al-Qaeda's network. They breed, they'll provide training camps, they'll send leadership back and forth, they'll send operatives back and forth, and ultimately that will feed into an attack here in the United States.
Well, let me stop on Salamander's interview for a minute and ask the pointed question about, of all these evils facing us, all of a sudden we're going after the Lord's Resistance Army, which, as far as I know, is, although truly evil, I guess, is a local problem. Why? Of all the wars we could pick to fight, what is the deal with that one? Have you got a clear idea why we're doing it?
I wish I had more information on that, but I don't. I know that President Obama, people forget this, but he mentioned this, I think it was either right before or right after he was elected, that he would like to do this. It's taken two plus years for this to come to fruition. Part of this could be a payback for the Ugandans providing thousands of African Union peacekeepers in Somalia. I can only guess at that. But, you know, this is something, you know, I mean, look, we really should not get involved with groups like this, in my opinion, unless they pose a clear and present danger to the United States. And, you know, you could see that with Shabab. You could see that with Al-Qaeda, other Al-Qaeda affiliates, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But why the Lord's Resistance Army gets lumped in this is really beyond me.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, that's firmly under the, you know, some people cynically call it, and I think I've called it occasionally, humanitarian imperialism, but it's a classic case of wandering around the world in search of dragons to kill. And if you really think that heading into Central Africa to go after a death cult like that is something you can do quickly and leave, you know, good luck. And I wish our folks on the ground a quick return when they get back from executing the orders they've received. But going through the news this morning, there's a great disconnect, I think, except for a few cautious voices that were reminding everybody, well, you know, the only political force really ready to move in Egypt is the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt continues to set its roots. The Islamist Party is expected to win and take power in what was once very secular Tunisia. And we're already getting some uncomfortable sounds coming from Libya in that respect. So the Arab Spring is turning into Maghreb winter. We'll probably see more by January and February. Especially Southern Europe, we're going to see a very different southern coast of the Mediterranean than the West has seen in a very, very long time with the way these trend lines are going. Do you see our European allies really have a sober view of what lies just across a very, very small Middle Sea? And they have a long history there with what happens when that part of the world gets a little nasty.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, you would think that they might have seen this by now. There's been more than enough arrests in these areas, and yet the flow of immigration from these areas and the checks and balances that should be there don't. Really don't seem to be there. They just don't seem to recognize this as a long-term problem. And, you know, you had said the Arab Spring becoming a Maghreb winter. And I think that unfortunately is going to be correct. And we have to remember that one of the things, you know, whether we like or dislike a Mubarak or a Gaddafi, these people served as checks and balances against terror groups from operating in the region. And, you know, unfortunately, with them going, you know, this is one of the things they wanted. They wanted to overthrow Mubarak's regime. They are happy that groups that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to rise to power. Because even let's say that the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't take over the Egyptian government, still what happens in a place like Egypt is a lot of the breaks, the police state isn't in existence anymore to keep these terror groups from operating in the open. And, you know, given that a lot of the support network for terrorist operations in Europe, it comes from North Africa, this problem is just going to grow and grow over time. And with unless, you know, Europeans particularly seem to want a far more open world with open borders, but you know, when you have problems like this in existence, it isn't something that is going to be sustainable over time.
Well, there are a lot of other issues. I mean, is Saudi Arabia, let me put it this way, is Saudi Arabia in danger of becoming one of these Arab Spring, and I'll use the in the sense that Sal just used it, is there a risk there, an exposure there?
Yeah, it's really difficult to know until it actually happens, right? But I think the Saudis run a pretty efficient security state and are willing to do whatever it takes to suppress any potential uprising in their country. And not just in their country, but in the neighboring states. I believe it was what they sent thousands of troops, was it to Bahrain, is that correct? In order to put down, you know, the Arab Spring movement there. And if they're willing to do that in a country right next door, I believe that, you know, they put a lot of effort into their security institutions. I believe that they'll do what they have to do to crack down on these. When we look at what Bashar al-Assad is doing in Syria, you know, I think that's what, you know, what a real strong man is going to do to protect his power. And I believe that that's what the Saudis, who have a lot to lose in this, and the royal family is, you know, there's thousands of members in the royal family. All of those members have a lot to lose if the Saudi government goes under, and they're gonna pull all the strings needed in order to remain in power.
Well, Eagle One, did you have a follow on or no?
Well, I was gonna. It's sort of a follow on. How much mischief is Iran up to in Iraq that we can talk about?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually think it's decreased since the 2005-2008 time frame. You know, Prime Minister Maliki always gets accused of being an Iranian stooge and, you know, being under the influence of the Iranians. But everyone forgets that in early 2008, he launched a devastating offensive against the Mahdi army and the special groups. Those are the Iranian-backed terror groups, the League of the Righteous, or Asib al-Haq, Hezbollah brigades, and the Ghazali network, etc. You know, and really put these groups back on its edge. They went after Iran's, not just the individuals, but they really went and rooted out like command headquarters and captured a lot of Quds Force agents, etc. And that really set Iran's network, the military network inside of Iraq, back, I think, several years. And I don't think they've been able to recoup from that just yet. And this is one of the reasons why I dislike the decision to pull all of our forces out of Iraq without a fight. Because let's remember, we still have 2 months left in the year, and yet we've given up on negotiating a status of forces agreement with Iraq. But I think the Iranians, they still are supporting these groups. They're supporting Hezbollah brigades, and the Asib al-Haq, and you know, and the Promised Day Brigade, which is a Mahdi army offshoot, or the successor to the Mahdi army. But those groups, they may conduct attacks here and there. And there was, I believe, in June, they killed, I believe, 13 U.S. soldiers. It hasn't been, you know, this year. And that was the most in several years. They really haven't been able to conduct operations inside of Iraq the way that they used to. It's I think they've been marginalized. But that doesn't mean they're not a threat. It doesn't mean that Iran, you know, may decide, given that we've decided to pretty much give up on Iraq by and large, they may decide to redouble their efforts and give it a go again. And that's one of the things that really makes me worry. I think we've come this far in Iraq, and I think we should see this one through in order for the blood and treasure that we've sacrificed, in order that to mean something. We should make the extra commitment to see Iraq to the finish line.
Yeah, 75 days to come home is just something that just doesn't sit right with me, especially when you look at it from the point of view of cultures that you lose face and you negotiate hard in the souk. It just looks ugly all the way around. Hey, we're down to about 90 seconds. I just wanted to kind of roll your way and ask you, obviously, people can grab your stuff over at the Long War Journal. What are some of the topics you're going to be spending a lot of time, and maybe some of the people that you write with are going to be spending a lot of time with that we can look forward to reading soon?
Yeah, sure. We're obviously spending a lot of time on Afghanistan and Pakistan, always tracking the drone strikes that are occurring, not just in Pakistan, but Yemen and Somalia as well. Those have increased over the last couple of years. I think these are important not because of the technology that's being used, but because of the fact that the U.S. is waging basically undeclared wars in countries. and I find that to be fascinating. Tom Joslin continues to look at the Gitmo and other issues of that nature. Yemen, Al-Qaeda's operations in Yemen continue to be interesting. They just retook control of a provincial capital in the south and control much of southern Yemen. So that's a big story. Operations in Somalia is a big story. And, those are the big things that we're tracking right about now. Certainly a lot going on. You have to wonder how much of this is, is just in the case of Somalia, is this good news? Are we beating Shabab? But how long this can basically last? Are we in a downturn for Al-Qaeda in places like Somalia? Or are they on the upswing when these operations end? So it's a real interesting time, and it is a long war. There's a lot to track, and we're doing our best to keep an eye on it all.
And for the listeners, I just wanted to back up Bill there. The Long War Journal is a great resource. Pull back the second or third layers. For instance, if anybody really wants to know what people are talking about, how the rise in U.S. airstrikes in Pakistan for the last few years, if you're not a technical guy and you like pictures, they all got it in pretty little graphs and multicolors. So it's really a great resource that y'all built there, Bill, on something that needs to be watched and people need to pay attention to. And thank you very much for coming in this Saturday. It's been a great hour, Bill.
Thanks, gentlemen. Always a pleasure. Thanks. And you guys have a great rest of the weekend.
Thanks, Bill.
Take care.
You too. And thank you, everybody, for listening live. And for those that got us on the archive or on the podcast, hope you all have a great Navy Day.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.